Good morning, everybody. We're going to be going through the book of Hebrews over the next, so it's 13 lessons. How many weeks does it end up being? Is it 6.5 or something? I guess that would make sense. Yeah, I can do math. All right, so David Williams and I are going to be teaching this. I think the only class David is scheduled to teach is next Sunday morning because I'm going to be out of town and I'm going to be in town all the rest of them. And so that's going to be the plan for what we're doing. I printed out 80 copies of the material, and I have never had a printer before that stapled the material for me, and that was really exciting. So it was really easy for me to do that, so I'll have more printed out by Wednesday. I'll try to have more out. Does anybody else still need some? Because I think it was all taken up. All right, yeah, I'll make sure to have some more. I'm sorry about that. So that'll be available on Wednesday. You got an extra one right now? Who? Now all the hands went down. Yeah. All right, so what we're going to do this morning is we're going to briefly introduce the book of Hebrews, and then we're going to look at the first three verses, which set up a lot of the themes that are going to be woven throughout the book as we study this. I asked Larry Jones to open us up with a word of prayer, so let's go ahead and do that. One of the things that Larry mentioned in his prayer just now is that studying the book of Hebrews, we're going to be able to see a lot of shadows and pictures from the Old Testament that Jesus fulfills. And so if you feel like your Old Testament knowledge needs a lot of work, studying the book of Hebrews, even though it's a New Testament book, demands that we go back and look at a lot of Old Testament ideas and concepts. And so we'll do that as we go through this and make some of those connections. But this morning, we're going to go ahead and start with introducing the book right now. Typical way that oftentimes books are introduced begins with authorship. The interesting thing about the book of Hebrews is that we don't know who the author is. I've seen a book that's about 500 pages long, and it's titled Who Wrote the Book of Hebrews, and I don't want to read that book. I think sometimes questions like this can lead to a lot of vain discussion that don't ultimately build anybody up. But here's some things that we do know about the author, or some things that we can deduce from the book. The first is that the author was not an eyewitness. We know that in chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where he says, "How shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard." And I think the ones who heard are the ones who heard Jesus directly, is the idea there. And so it was attested to us by those people. So I think the idea of this is that whoever wrote this book had some kind of direct contact with the apostles, maybe, but he himself wasn't an eyewitness. Some people have suggested that Paul was the author, but 2 Thessalonians 3:17, Paul says that in all of his letters, he signs them, and it's a sign of genuineness in all of the letters that he writes. And we don't have that in the book of Hebrews, so I don't think it would have been Paul. We do know later on in the book that the author knew Timothy. Timothy at this time was in prison, and Paul had told Timothy in 2 Timothy to not be ashamed and to keep boldly preaching and everything like that. And it seems like Timothy took that so much to heart that he ended up going to jail, just like Paul eventually did. But this at least puts the author in the same time period as Timothy. He had contact with the apostles. So it was somebody that I think the original audience would have known. And beyond that, I don't know that I have much more to say about the authorship, if anybody has any things that they would want to add to that. Yeah. Yeah, and ultimately it came from the Holy Spirit. Who the human side of it was, we're not sure, but that's ultimately what matters as we study this. So, good. All right, let's think about the audience then. What is it that the audience is going through that would make this writer say the things that he does in this book? Now, the beginning of the book that we're going to look at in just a moment doesn't begin by saying so-and-so to such-and-such people, greetings and all of these different kinds of things. There's a couple passages later in the book that give us some details about what the audience is going through. Look at the first one here. Go all the way to chapter 10. And this is where we get perhaps the most detail about the audience in this book. In Hebrews chapter 10, verses 32 to 34, it says, "But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings." Just stop there for a minute. Notice that the text says that they were enlightened, and then what did they experience? Sufferings. What does the world tell you? That if you get enlightened, the sufferings go away? In this case, you were enlightened, and then you started to suffer. Look at verse 33. "Sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated, for you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you yourselves knew that you had a better, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one." All right, based on those few verses there, what is the audience going through? Or what have they gone through? Yeah, persecution. What kinds of persecution do you see here? Right, their property had actually been seized, and it says that they were able to joyfully accept that. We just bought a house. If somebody was to take it from us, I'm not sure that my first thought would, my reaction would be joy. If somebody stole my car, I'm not sure that that would be my first reaction. These people, and it, by the way, if the audience is Jewish, even if they lived in Rome, which is possibly where the audience was, what did property mean to the Jewish mindset? Remember in the book of Joshua, they carve up all the promised land? Land was very, very important to the Jews. And so for these people, who I think would have been Jewish Christians, for them to joyfully accept the plundering of their property is an amazing change of attitude that perhaps they would have had to make under what Jesus has done for them. So anything else that you guys see about the nature of the persecution they went through? What other things were they experiencing? Yeah, they were being ridiculed. They were exposed to reproach, publicly exposed to reproach. I don't know what that would have looked like. Would that have looked like a group of people kind of circling around the Christians and making fun of them and all of that? It would have been very shameful for them at times. But they were willing to endure all of that and go through it. And so it seems like throughout this book we're going to see that persecution started to wear the audience down a little bit. We know that none of them have been martyred yet. If you look at chapter 12, verse 4. He says, "In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood." I take that to mean that the audience, what they've been experiencing has not been so much death threats. Well, maybe there were death threats, but none of them have actually been killed yet. Which would mean that the society around them doesn't really appreciate their faith. They're saying things against their faith, but they haven't been killed. All right, does that sound kind of like the nation that we live in? People are less and less appreciating the things that Christians seek to do, but we haven't been martyred. We haven't been killed yet. And so what this audience is in need of is encouragement because they're discouraged. In fact, go down to verses 12 and 13 in chapter 12. The writer says, therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. He's saying some of you guys, some of your ligaments have been disjointed, and you need to put this all back together so you can keep running the race that's set before you, is the idea. All right, anything else that you guys want to say about the audience and what they're going through and how that's affecting them? All right, this gets us to the message of the book then. What exactly is the writer trying to do for this audience? The end of the book, look at chapter 13, verse 22. The writer says, I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly. All right. Does anybody know how long it takes to read the book of Hebrews? It's about 45 minutes. And he says that this is a brief word of exhortation. There's a couple times in the book where he says, I could say more about this, but I don't have time to. He says that a couple times. And so there's things that he could have expanded on that he didn't. And so you can imagine in his mind why he's saying this is a pretty brief word of exhortation. But he tells the audience, I want you to bear with this word of exhortation. What kinds of things do we have to bear with? Things that are typically hard, right? Like things that are not easy to hear. It reminds me of 2 Timothy 4, where Paul tells Timothy that there's going to be a time where people will not endure sound doctrine. We have to be able to endure or bear with the things that the Scripture says, because we don't necessarily always want to hear it. But this author is giving them exactly what they need to hear, and he's pleading with them to bear with this word of encouragement, exhortation, the things that he's writing to them in that way. Now, the way he's going to do this throughout the book is he's going to keep coming back to this idea that Jesus is better, he's greater, he's superior. He's better than anything else that you'd ever want to go back to. Now, it seems like the audience, being Hebrew Christians, were in danger of going back to Judaism. How many of us this morning, because of the social pressure against Christianity and everything like that, how many of you are just really tempted to become Jewish again? That's not really my situation. So what is the value of studying a book like this? If the original audience, if that seemed to be what they were going through, how can we take this idea that Jesus is better? This thing is really weird. If Jesus is better, greater, superior to everything in the Old Testament, to try to help them realize that they shouldn't go back to that, what are the kinds of things that we're tempted to go back to? The world in general? What were you saying? Yeah, things that we're comfortable with, things that didn't really bring us any kind of persecution and stuff like that. That could be a different thing for everybody here. So what we do when we study a book like this, here's a general outline. This is an oversimplified outline of the book of Hebrews. The first 10 chapters, the writer is going to bring up, for lack of a better term, doctrine about Jesus' superiority, specifically to things like angels, Moses, priests, sacrifices. And then in chapters 11 through 13, he's going to talk to them about enduring the suffering that they need to go through. Now, as he goes through all of this stuff, there's going to be a series of warnings, and some people will outline the warnings differently. If I can get this thing to work here. Okay, so you see right here, some people will outline the warnings differently. There's around 4 or 5 or 6 warning passages in the book, where he'll kind of take a break from this heavy stuff he's saying about angels or these things about priests. He's going to take a break for a second and say, and by the way, this means this for our life. And so we'll see those things as we go through this. But I'm not tempted to go back to the things that angels said above Jesus. And I'm not tempted to go back to the law of Moses above Jesus. But what the writer is doing is he's breaking down the nature of the things that you're tempted to go back to and saying that that's actually not the right decision because Jesus is better. So if you're tempted to go back into the world, think about all the things that attract you to the world. And piece by piece, Jesus is better than each one of those things, is maybe how we could apply some of the principles of this book. But that's the overall, I think, outline of the book. Anything you guys want to add to that or comment on with that? All right, we're going to go back to this chart as we go through this class. I'll have the chart up on every class to remind us of some of this. Yeah, Vera? Yeah. That's right. I think we can, I liked how you described that, that our departure from the faith can be soft. Like, could we still go to church every week, but just in our workplace or our school or wherever we are, just not ever talk about the Lord ever? And now I know that there's ways that we should and shouldn't do that, but are there ways that we could just completely shut out with regards to how we try to influence the world? But we still go to church and all of these different kinds of things. But effectively, our faith is dead throughout the whole week. That would be a softer way that we could do the same thing that the audience is in danger of here. Russ? Yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Russ, in case you guys didn't hear, Russ was saying that the audience has already endured quite a bit. And maybe they see on the horizon that society is getting even worse. And even though they might be able to look back and go, yeah, God helped me through these times, they just don't feel like they can deal with what's coming in front of them, which would cause them to fall in those kinds of ways, which, again, could kind of fit our situation today a little bit more than we might think. All right, good. Anything else you guys want to say before we get into the first three verses for today? All right, let's go ahead. I'll go ahead and read verses, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, and we'll break this down in two parts. First of all, how does this text say how God used to speak? And then how does this text tell us how he speaks now under the new covenant? So we'll break it down in that way. So look at chapter 1, verses 1 through 3. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Alright, so how, in this text, there's this contrast between the way that God used to operate and the way that he does now under the new covenant. So try to think, first of all, how did God used to speak according to verse 1? And you notice, when he brings up the first three verses here, he just gets straight to business in this. When is it that God used to speak? Well, first of all, it was long ago. You remember, even back, by the way, how God created the world was by his communication. He spoke things into existence. And so long ago, God has been communicating from a long time ago, and at many different times. It wasn't just one time long ago. You can track all the different periods of history for the Israelites, their time in the wilderness, the patriarchal period, like some people say, the Mosaic period. The United Kingdom, Divided Kingdom, return from exile, even when they were in exile, and all of these different times, beginning from a long time ago, God has been communicating to, we'll see who in just a second, but God, this is showing us that God has a history of speaking. Have you ever had a time before where there was somebody that you knew that you just wanted to know what they were thinking, but they wouldn't say anything? With God, we don't have to guess. There's some questions we're never going to have answered. But with God, He has a history of communicating, so we don't have to make up what we think His will should be. God does communicate, which is an amazing thing in and of itself. So that's maybe some things about when He communicated in the past. Any comments or questions on that? All right, notice then to whom? According to verse 1, who is it that He communicated to? Yeah, to our fathers. Note, when he says our fathers, I think he's talking about the Israelite heritage and the ancestors and everything like that. Which, by the way, could be a strong indication that the audience was Jewish. If he says God spoke to our fathers, maybe you could have Jew and Gentile, and you could say that, you know, Abraham is our father in those kinds of ways. But I think you can make an argument for this, that this audience was Jewish, and that's why he's saying our fathers there. But the Israelites in the Old Testament were the people that received God's special communication. Anybody know why God specifically communicated to the Israelites in the Old Testament? They were His people, and what was God wanting to accomplish with His people through this communication? Special relationship, what were you saying? Okay, to bring them to Christ, what else? To be a holy nation. Remember, this is an oftentimes forgotten passage. This one here in Deuteronomy 4, verses 6 through 8, is an amazing passage. Where God tells, where Moses is speaking to the people, and they're almost into the promised land. And Moses tells the people that God has given us these instructions and these statutes and these laws. And the reason that he's doing that is so that when the nations see us following these things, the people all around them will say, what other nation is so wise and so understanding as these people because of what God has given them? So God was wanting to accomplish something with the world through these people that he was communicating to. That same thing would be true for us as well. But this is the people that God spoke to primarily in the Old Covenant. Now, here's this next question. How is it that he communicated to these people? So we got the when, the to whom. How did he do it? And you notice in this text, it was through the prophets. Which means that this writer is putting his stamp of approval on everything that the prophets of the Old Testament wrote. Think about the different ways. Well, let's first of all name some of the prophets. Just start shouting out names of some of the prophets. Elijah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Isaiah. Then you got a lot of the ones that are in 1st and 2nd Kings, but they didn't write any books that we have recorded for us. But you got all kinds of prophets. Now, it says that specifically to the prophets, God communicated in many ways. This isn't talking about like when Balaam's donkey would speak. That's not what's in view here. This is how God spoke to the prophets particularly. Can you guys think of some of the ways that God spoke to the prophets? Through dreams, what else? Visions? Okay, yeah, to Elijah on the mountain. So you got God personally communicating, at least to Moses. You've got visions, we got that one. Angels with Daniel, in Daniel chapter 10, we've got angels talking to Daniel. What about Hosea's life experience? Being told to marry a prostitute and how she's going to cheat on him and everything like that. Very different ways for different people. God is communicating the same message, but he's using a vast amount of resources to make that happen. Now, one point to make from this is that the way that God communicated in the Old Testament was fragmentary. It was varied. You've got, over the course of a couple thousand years, God doing it kind of piecemeal by piecemeal to different prophets. Now, there was a period of time where God did not send prophets. Anybody know what time period that was? Yes, the Old New Testament, between that time period, anybody know how many years that was? 400 years. Anybody know which prophecies in the Old Testament still talk about that time period? Even though there was no living prophets in that time period? Daniel chapter 11 and 12, primarily Daniel chapter 11 gives an amazing history of Alexander the Great and all of these things that was going to happen in that time period. So there are prophecies about that time period. But that would be maybe one of the exceptions, that was a period of time where God did not send prophets. The book of Amos seems to indicate it's because you guys weren't ever listening anyways, so there's no point in sending more of them. All right, so this is how God used to speak. Any comments or questions about that before we see how he speaks in the New Covenant? All right, so how has God now spoken then? Let's ask the same questions. When? Well, the text says that it's in these last days. Now, there's some people that will see that phrase in the Bible, and every time they see that phrase, they're tempted to think, well, these last days is referring to the time leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem. And I'm not sure that that's the point that he's bringing up here. I think the idea is more so, it's the last days referring to the Christian era that the Old Testament prophets talked about was going to happen. Isaiah, Jeremiah, these prophets that were just mentioned, they talked about these latter days, or these last days, which was going to be the final dispensation, for lack of another term, or era of how things were going to work before the new heavens and the new earth and everything like that. And so I think that's what he means by in these last days. Anybody want to say anything about that or disagree with that? All right, I want to say something about what he's saying here. And this is kind of going a little ahead of ourselves, but I want to say this now. When he says that God has now spoken in these last days, he's going to say in just a minute that it's through his Son, which is obviously far superior than everything that they had in the Old Covenant. I think we as Christians need to appreciate how much of a privileged era that we live in. We have something that the prophets looked forward to. We have something that shows a greater revelation than all the saints of the Old Testament. So, for example, in Hebrews chapter 11, where it brings up all of these people of faith, and like Sarah and Abraham and Moses and some of the judges and stuff like that, here's a question about all of those people that this book will use New Testament Christians to motivate. Who knows more about God? Us or those people? We do. We have a greater revelation than all of these people in the past who might even be more faithful than we are, even though they had less knowledge of God. We live in a very privileged era to have the full revelation of God, or the final revelation that he wants to bring through Jesus. Any comments or questions just about those ideas there before we look at the next question? All right, then notice this next part. Who is he speaking to here? With regards to the Old Covenant, he was speaking through to the Israelites. Who does it say here in this text? To us. All right, who is the us? What was it? The people he was talking to, who happened to be Christians. I like that he says to us, if we read it in a personal kind of way. He used to speak to the fathers that we weren't part of that, but now he's spoken to us, and one of the challenges throughout the book is, are we listening? We're going to see that a little bit as we wrap up the class after we look at some more of these details here. But this is going to be one of the challenges throughout the book, that we don't drift away from the message that we've heard, that we don't refuse him who is speaking to us. And I think that's important to see those things there. All right. Anything else about the to whom there? All right. Notice then how, and we're going to expand on this part more than any other here right now. How is he speaking now? Through his Son. And in just a minute, we're going to see all the descriptions of Jesus in this text. But before we do that, let me just bring this point out. Part of what I think the writer is saying here is that we shouldn't expect God to communicate to us today the same way that he did in the Old Testament to the prophets anymore. So there's a genre of literature called heavenly tourism. like books and movies that people have written about people that have had heavenly experiences and all of these different kinds of things. And I think passages like this say that that's not really how God is communicating in the New Covenant now. Even though some of those books and movies become very popular, even sometimes amongst Christians. So, all right, that's the how. We're going to see who Jesus is and the description of this one that he's communicating through. We could organize the descriptions of Jesus in verses 2 and 3 around three basic ideas, which Hebrews is going to bring up, that Jesus is the king, he is the prophet, and he's the priest. We typically say prophet, priest, and king because that sounds better, but we're going to do it in this order. These descriptions of Jesus, I think, can center on these ideas here. So notice, first of all, how this text describes Jesus as being the king. And I think there's a past, present, and future aspect to this. Jesus in the past, according to this text, is the creator of the world. Or Jesus is through whom the one that the Father used to create the world. If he's the creator of the world, that also means he's the ruler of the world. And so in the past, God used Jesus to create the world. In the present, he upholds all things by the word of his power, or his powerful word that he's still communicating in order to keep the world together, is holding it all together. And then in the future, he is the heir of all things. Which, by the way, if Jesus is the heir of all things and we're married to him, what does that mean that we get? We're joint heirs with the blessings of God. And so I think, even though this is not necessarily the order that the writer is bringing up all these things, I'm just trying to organize this in a way that helps us discuss these things. Anything you guys want to say about Jesus being the king? All right, notice then that he's the prophet. What was the role of a prophet in the Old Covenant? Yeah, convey God's message, to reveal God to people. Jesus is going to do this in a very, in a way, obviously much greater than the prophets of the Old Testament. Jesus is described as the radiance of the glory of God. Now, in the Old Testament, do you remember when they make the tabernacle? What happens in the tabernacle? God's glory, what the Jews called the Shekinah glory, comes on it. And then at the end of Exodus, you've got this great climactic moment, but they can't come into the tabernacle because God's glory is kind of making it so they can't come in. And then later on in Old Testament history, David wants to build a temple for God, and Nathan says yes, but then he says no, and that his son is going to have to build it. And then when Solomon finally builds the temple, what happens in the temple? God's glory comes upon it. And then what does Babylon do to that temple? They destroy it in 586. And then there's prophecies like in Isaiah, or there's prophecies in somewhat in Daniel, where it talks about how the glory of God is going to return back to the people. So then in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, when they build the temple, guess what doesn't come on the new temple? God's glory doesn't come on it. But then here comes Jesus, and God, the radiance of the glory of God is in the temple of Jesus now. So that's where God is choosing to glorify himself. Jesus is functioning in that kind of way. Also, this text says that Jesus is the exact imprint of his nature. This is this word was used not in other places in the Bible. I think this is the only time this word is actually used in the Bible. But in other Greek literature, this word for exact imprint was used for how people would mint coins, and how it would be the same imprint on the coin as it is on the molding, or whatever the right word would be for that. This is showing us that Jesus, remember the purpose of mankind was to be the image of God, to reflect God, and when people look at you, they see the character of God. Jesus is the exact imprint of God's nature. And so when you see him, you see the Father, just like he says in the Gospel of John. All right, so that's Jesus, I think, revealing the Father in those ways. Anything you guys want to say about that? You notice that I'm not very good at asking discussion questions. I just kind of say what I say, and then I see if anybody wants to say anything else about it. I need to get better about that. All right, notice then how he's a priest. How does this text show us that Jesus is a priest? What did he do here that priests do? Yeah, he made purification for sins. Isn't it interesting that in this discussion of who Jesus is, he's the one who created the world, he's the one that holds it all together, and this powerful God has used all of his power to do what? To make purification for sins. It's amazing to see the humility that it took for him to do that, and the fact that even though he's so powerful and so above us, he would still love us enough to do that. But later in the book of Hebrews, he's going to say that he purifies our conscience in order to serve him. He's going to say that in 9:14. All right, so if we appreciate what Jesus has done for us by purifying us, what's the proper response that we're supposed to have? What is that supposed to mean for us? That we serve him. When Jesus heals people, he heals you just not just so that you can feel good about where you are now, but so that you have the freedom to be able to serve and help and do the things that he's asked you to do. So he made purification for sins. And notice also that when he did that, he sat down. Now, what do you guys think is the importance of him sitting down? It shows his power to be able to be the one that sits down. Okay. What else do you guys think about this idea of sitting down? Sure. Okay, good. Place of honor. What else? He's reigning. Yeah. Yeah, you're through with something. Throughout the book of Hebrews, he's going to say this a few times. Four times, actually, that Jesus has sat down. Now, this is with reference to him being the priest. All right. When you read Exodus 25 through 31, you see all the instructions for the tabernacle, and we get really interested at all the furniture that's in the house of God. There's a table, there's a lamp. What's missing? It's not really missing, but what does God not include? There's no chair. And I think the implication of this, that for the priests, how often did they have to continually bring purification for sins for the people? The Day of Atonement once a year, but then other people were also bringing sacrifices during the year as well. Their work was never completed. And so for this text to say that with reference to Jesus being the priest, for him to sit down means, unlike all the priests in the Old Covenant, his work has been completed. And so that's exactly what we just said there. All right. Anybody have anything else they want to add to this idea of him being the priest? Vera? Right, that's right. So for him to sit down means that the priestly work forever has been accomplished. We don't need... Right. In other words, we don't need high priests today and everything. There's a sense in which Christians are priests, but that's not in the same way that this is talking about. But yes, very good. Anything else just about that? Yeah. Sure. Yes, I think, okay, so when it says that he's the exact imprint, well, I thought that if somebody saw God in all of his glory, what would happen to them? You would die, right? So one of my favorite hymns is Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and part of the hymn says, veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Why did Jesus come in the form of a human being? I think it was the closest he could get to us, but at the same time not letting it kill us. So when God comes on Mount Sinai in Exodus 19, and he's in this dark cloud and everything, is he trying to be menacing and scary? Or is it God's way of trying to create enough distance to not kill the people, but still come down to where they are? It's like if I'm wrestling with Asher, I have enough strength to really hurt him, but I have to descend down to his level of strength and let him beat me and all of that sort of thing. That's not a great illustration, but in order for God to be able to get at our level, he needs to humble himself like he did in the person of Jesus in order for us to see him as closely as we can. Now, there's times like on the Mount of Transfiguration where he's going to flex some of his spiritual muscles and we're going to see how glorious he really is, but as he was in his body, he was veiled in that flesh, just like a lamp shade needs to shade some of the light so it doesn't hurt our eyes, I think is the idea there. But yeah. Good. Yep. Yeah, sitting down with the Father. Yeah. Yeah, good. Anything else? All right, so then here's maybe one of the big takeaways from this. If this is how God used to communicate, in the Old Covenant, did God expect people to listen to him? If we have greater communication and greater revelation in the New Covenant, how much greater should it be expected that we're listening to what the Son says? So I'm just going to bring up these passages now. We're going to look at them as we go through these passages, even on Wednesday. But Hebrews 2:1. Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Or in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 25, see that you do not refuse him who is speaking. Do you see how at the beginning of this book he says, this is how God did communicate, this is how he now communicates, and threaded throughout the book he's going to say, so make sure that we're listening. Now, how do we know if we're listening? If we're doing it, if we're not drifting away, if we're putting it into practice, if we're talking about it with other people, I think that's part of what chapter 12, verses 12 and 13 is talking about with the ligaments that are getting disjointed. I think he's actually using that as a metaphor for that church that he's writing to. And he's saying, hey, you guys got to help the ones that are weak right now. And so we're trying to encourage other people and get them on the right track and everything like that. But do we see that the Old Testament saints who lived faithful lives, like Abraham, like Job, like Moses, like Joshua, like Caleb, like all of these different people that we look at and go, wow, like amazing faith. If they could be resurrected from the grave right now and talk to us face to face, I wonder if they would say, do you realize how much better you have it than we did? You have all the more inspiration and motivation to give your whole lives up for the Lord. Because the things that we wrote about, the things that we saw through the eyes of faith, we just dreamed of what that would be like one day, and you're the ones who have it now. It's amazing. All right, anything else that you guys want to add to or take away from that? All right, on Wednesday, we will be looking at chapter 1, verse 4 through chapter 2, verse 18, and we'll look at how Jesus is greater than the angels, and that'll be what we talk about then. So thanks a lot, guys.